are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 13th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, civilizing torture, an American tradition, with W. Fitz Brundage. Also on the program today, Trump's trade war with China coming to a head. But it's nothing like real war, says Tom Cotton. Also, 44 states sue generic drug makers on price fixing. And the Supreme Court rules against Apple, a massive antitrust suit over the Apple Store, to continue. Meanwhile, Joe Biden increases his lead. Beto launches 2.0. And the Senate Democratic prospects seem to be in danger because so many of those potential candidates are running for president. Meanwhile, Pentagon diverting $1.5 billion for Trump's wall. And Chuck Schumer's big 2020 gambit. Outlaw robocalls. And the heartwarming tale of a South Carolinian Republican lawmaker's being attacked after retelling of her rape in the course of an abortion debate. Saudi tankers supposedly sabotaged off the UAE coast. Chelsea Manning may be headed back to jail as a new grand jury convenes investigating Julian Assange. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. It is Monday. Everybody's here except for Michael. Michael has the cold that's going around this office. I thought I had allergies, and now I'm starting to think that maybe I've had a cold.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I think I got your cold over the weekend.
Try taking some Claritin.
I've taken Claritin, and it sort of helped.
I think I might have caught the same allergies, unfortunately.
There's a lot of that going around. Tonight, folks, big Green New Deal rally, AOC, Bernie, others. And I believe it's taking place at Howard University. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I imagine it'll be streaming online. Should be exciting. It will be at Howard University. And it is being organized by the Sunrise Movement, which, of course, is that group that occupied Nancy Pelosi's office at the beginning of this Democratic, or I should say, congressional session. And all of that happening with this sort of backdrop, as you know, Joe Biden the other day said he's developing a new climate change plan that is going to be more moderate. He's trying to strike a balance between telling the world not to get so hot and us doing something about it. He's going to try and meet nature halfway and see if nature will compromise a little bit.
Global lukewarming.
Yeah. He's going to basically say, why be so hot? Why not be a little bit less hot?
And he's going to put his hand on Mother Nature's back.
There you go. He's going to say, maybe I can...
Calm down, honey.
Maybe, exactly. Maybe I can help you with some of that tension. And then he's just going to say, oh, well, forgive me, Father. I've sinned. But here is Biden... Now, folks, the reality is his lead is expanding. And really across the board, I still contend. I mean, nothing's changed in the past 4 days, 5 days that I made this contention last week, that by September, Democratic voters will have a different sense of who Joe Biden is. I mean, people just aren't largely paying attention to this race, largely. And the idea of a guy who's already been vice president under an extremely popular president sounds very, very appealing, particularly one who is like a guy you'd apparently want to have a beer with. And but I have a feeling, and maybe this is hopeful, this is more aspirational maybe than it should be, but that as folks get a better look and they start to key in, when we start to see debates and we start to, maybe even by the fall, by I guess late September, October, that people will have a sort of a more sophisticated understanding of who Joe Biden is. For instance, you'll recall, because this happened months ago, so people may not remember it, but in 2018, the Democrats had the largest midterm victory that has ever been recorded in terms of votes. And the biggest issue that people ran on, and I think it is a mistake to just assume that it was just this issue. Frankly, I think it was a referendum on Donald Trump, and there was a lot of disdain for Donald Trump. But the vehicle in which Democrats made this case was through the notion of health care. And about 50% of the candidates were running on Medicare for All. Others were running on some variant of expanding health care access to people and affordability to people. And I imagine that Joe Biden's going to do the same, but this is a guy who clearly is not terribly keyed into this issue. Listen to his explanation as to why we shouldn't have a Medicare buy-in. I mean, this explanation, as far as I'm concerned, covers a Medicare buy-in. It covers an expansion of Medicare for All. It basically, it's a bizarre reasoning, but apparently he feels this will suffice. Here's Joe Biden being asked about health care.
What do you say to calls for some sort of universal health care or something like Medicare for All from some of the other people running
well,
the Democratic primary?
I think they're well-intended. I think they mean it, but here's the deal. Right now, you have this overwhelming number of employers who are paying into the health care plan. Why let them off the hook? All of a sudden, they don't have to pay anything. What happens then to this whole thing about profit and the rest? I mean, should be part of the compensation if you have it.
What? Wait, I mean, this is one of the biggest problems with our health care is that it is tied to the employers. And I guess his argument is you're letting them off the hook, although taxes would go up on employers. They would end up paying more in taxes to pay for Medicare for All, if that's what he's really concerned about. I'm also really impressed by Joe Biden's sense of what the argument is with corporations having too much power and too many tax cuts in his reference of profits and that stuff.
Yeah, I have no idea what the hell he's talking about there.
Well, I mean, I totally get what he's saying. And it is nonsense. I mean, that's the worst part about this. This is not a gaffe. This is somebody who thinks that the argument should be the responsibility of employers to provide health insurance as opposed to the government. Everyone complains about the notion of being stuck at a job you don't want to be stuck at because it provides you health care. Everyone complains. The biggest refrain we used to hear when Joe Biden was running for president was that every GM car, $1,600 of it was a function of health care that they had to pay. This is just absurd. It is bizarre. And to the extent that Joe Biden, you know, has basically shielded himself, I think, from a lot of direct sort of interviews and reporting and questioning about his policies. That is just a remarkable thing to say, considering the fact that many of his votes come from the fact that he's so experienced. I mean, this is a guy who clearly has not even engaged in the issue. I mean, of all the issues you can come up with about Medicare for all, to argue that it somehow lets employers off the hook when we all know they're going to be paying more in taxes, but that's the problem. As if Medicare for all, the desire for people to have health insurance that is not only affordable, but easy, basically just getting health care, as if that desire is rooted in attacking businesses, is basically adopting a conservative right-wing frame and turning it on its head in a ludicrous fashion. I mean, it is beyond silly. And it's this type of stuff why I think Joe Biden ultimately is going to falter. And it really is just a function of whether his understanding of policies and his desire, you know, his prescriptions for the American public end up becoming more widely understood by the general electorate. So we shall see. But I'm shocked by that stuff.
He had to think on his feet, right, and come up with something that sounded kind of populist. And he's scrolling through the options in his head, like insurance companies. No, people don't like those. Credit card companies. No, no, no. Bosses. Yes, the bosses are bad. It lets them off.
I don't think he was thinking on his feet. I mean, it's impossible to imagine that they haven't said, like, how are you going to respond to the fact that people are calling for Medicare? I mean, this would be the day one, right?
It is weird that he just gestures vaguely populist as if it doesn't really matter what he says. It's just about tone.
Yeah.
Well, he might be right.
Yeah, no, he might. Folks, no need to suffer through another sleepless night. Thanks to Calming Comfort by Sharper Image. The luxurious weighted blanket is made with super soft velveteen material and designed with high density comfort fill to promote a sense of calmness. Plus, by applying an even amount of pressure over your body, Calming Comfort helps the production of serotonin and melatonin and mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged for a restful night's sleep. I will say this. It is still unseasonably cold in New York City. And I have to say that I have a confession to make. I'm happy about it. I like to sleep in the cold. I like a cold weather sleep. I've been keeping the window open. And I can still use my Calming Comfort blanket. So I get the full effect. I get that weighted feel, which makes me fall asleep faster, makes me stay asleep. And it really is a revelation of sorts. Because I'm also the type of person that likes to sleep on a couch. Because I like that feeling of being like a little bit, like in a cocoon. And this gives me that as well. The Calming Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. Now our listeners can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com. That's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJOR15 at checkout and receive $15 off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Promo code MAJOR15, because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep. CalmingComfortBlanket.com, promo code MAJOR15. And folks, while you're working on your stress, know that stress is a worldwide epidemic. We work longer hours, we're inundated with a constant news cycle, believe me, and we're more connected than ever before. Stress is a part of life. It can easily affect our overall wealth and well-being. That's why we're partnering with Calm, the number one app to help you reduce your anxiety and stress and help you sleep better. More than 40 million people around the world have downloaded it. If you head to calm.com/majority, you'll get a 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, including a brand new meditation each day. Sleep stories. They're bedtime stories for adults. They're designed to help you relax. Head to the magical lavender fields of southern France with Stephen Fry, or explore the moonlit jungles of Africa with Leona Lewis. They also have soothing music and more, all completely developed to help you sleep. Right now, Majority Report listeners get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/majority. That's calm.com/majority. Get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today at calm.com/majority. Get calm. Stop stressing. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, professor of history from UNC Chapel Hill, Fitz Brundage, on his Pulitzer-nominated book, Civilizing Torture, An American Tradition. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill, W. Fitz Brundage, author of the Pulitzer-nominated book, Civilizing Torture, An American Tradition. Fitz, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So your book is both a history of torture as practiced in this country, and I guess even before it was, in fact, a country, and the mechanism in which we have told ourselves that it hasn't happened in many respects. But let's start with the earliest examples of the use of torture in colonial times, I guess. What stands out as one that is archetypal for you?
Well, I think for me, what's archetypal is an incident I talk about, an episode that happened actually in what we would now call French Canada, because it's an interesting moment when we see a European settler, in this case a Jesuit priest, involved in a dialogue with a Huron Indian about the appropriateness of torture. And the reason I think it's such a rich moment in the history of this subject is because the Jesuit priest was trying to discourage the Huron Indians from torturing an Iroquois Indian who they had captured, as was a practice in Indian warfare. And there was the North American Indians had an elaborate kind of code, if you will, a kind of etiquette about how to apply torture and how it was done, when it was done, what was expected to be the behavior of the victim of their torture. as part of warfare. Well, the Huron's response to the Jesuits is, well, you torture, right? And the Jesuit says, oh, yes, we do torture, but we only torture in these circumstances. And you can see in the brief dialogue that we have, it's not even a dialogue, the account that we have, a back and forth between the Indian trying to figure out, okay, why is our torture bad, but your torture is okay? And simultaneously, the Jesuit trying to work out in his mind an argument for why Indian torture is barbaric, whereas European torture is not barbaric. So the reason I bring this up is because it's a moment when we see the Europeans being confronted with a different culture of torture and trying to figure out how they can, that is, how Europeans can persuade themselves, let alone Indians, that they are, in fact, a superior, more civilized people. And it's the working out of that, how it is that Europeans or Euro-American settlers, invaders, convince themselves that their culture of torture is somehow not antithetical to civilization, that I think is a very interesting moment in the history of the evolution of ideas about torture.
And the Huron, and you write that indigenous people here, anyways, their torture was a mechanism to essentially, in some ways, sort of almost to reset a captive so they could live amongst them.
Sometimes, although sometimes it was torture to death. And I guess here's the simplest way I would describe the difference. Of course, I'm talking about the, if you will, the idealized notion of torture in these societies.
Right.
We can be sure that there were instances where these events didn't follow the idealized norms at all. But in European society, torture, ever since the ancient Romans, had been assumed as a means by which you could extract the truth from a human being. You could use it to force them to tell you what they would say, what would be the honest truth, because the mind could not prevent the body from telling truth. So in the European mind, there's a relationship between bodily pain and truth, whereas for North American Indians, torture was a way in which one society of Indians, one Indian nation, could convey its disdain for its enemy. And simultaneously, the victim of the torture was supposed to, through his extreme ability to absorb torture, was supposed to reflect back his disdain for his torturers. So there was a very different purpose, if you will, to the acts of torture. Now, you would say from an outsider, what's happening in both instances is a human body is being subjected to horrific forms of bodily torture. And so superficially, torture is happening to both bodies, but for very different purposes. And Europeans often found the Indian, if you will, dialogue between the torturers causing pain and the torturer victim trying to mock the torment that he was suffering, they found that to be barbaric, whereas Indians found the idea of what Europeans were doing as to be incomprehensible.
And what was it? I mean, I don't want to jump too far ahead, or I want to be able to go through a couple of these sort of the developments in terms of the legal strategies and the I guess the rhetorical strategies in which to sort of allow this justification for torture. But what was it that ultimately about that European, or was there more of a sense with the European introduction of torture and what ultimately became sort of the American way of rationalizing it? Was there more a sense that there needed to be a rationalization as in terms of, like, we need to be able to justify this, unique justification for our torture, as opposed to from indigenous people who saw this as part of part of the relationship that they had with their enemies?
Yes, I think you're spot on that, and it's the European rationalization of torture was tied to many different concerns. One concern of the Europeans was, of course, that they were working out in their own minds, to their own satisfaction, the justifications for the kind of expropriation, invasion, decimation of American Indian societies. So part of it, you could say, is a rationalization, but it was also, I mean, there was and I'm not trying to mitigate at all this by saying that there was simultaneously an effort, so to speak, to elevate this to something more than just simply a crude land grab, which, of course, it was. But the rationalization, of course, was that they were going to Christianize these peoples if they could be Christianized, and, of course, they would also be civilized. And that was the notion somehow that the Europeans were going to be the bringers, if you will. They were going to disseminate civilization was a hugely powerful idea because it made the colonization, the invasion, something more than just simply a military act. But tied to that at the same time is that not in the case of French Canada, I was talking about before, but for many of the Protestant Europeans who were coming to what is now the United States, they also had this powerful association of torture with the Catholic Counter-Reformation, with the Inquisition, all of the stories about the dark, dark violence of the Spanish Inquisition throughout Western Europe. And so their association with torture as well was as a kind of tyrannical, despotic act. So there was the torture that they knew in the old world that they associated with the crushing out of true faith and as a kind of backward reactionary form of violence in their minds. And then there was the barbaric torture of Indians on the frontier. And so they were trying to carve out, if you will, a space where torture, they were not going to be engaged in the torture of the barbaric Indians as they saw them, nor were they going to replicate the torture they associated with, for example, the Spanish Inquisition.
Where does let's move a little further on the timeline, because I'm curious as to one of the things I find fascinating about the book and just about the sort of the tracking of how torture has been rationalized over the past 250 years, at least in this country, is it seems to be a subset of other rationalizations, right? That, and I wonder, you know, as we talk about the sort of the imperial project, I guess, of early settlers and taking indigenous people's lands, and then slavery. In all of this, there seems to be sort of a similar muscle that's being worked in terms of justifying it and establishing an other and whatnot. And I wonder, like, which comes first, the manifest destiny, and therefore when we do these things, or is it sort of has to be created in retrospect?
That is the $64 million question. And I wish I could tell you that I had a really cogent answer for that, but instead what I'll do is what I honestly think, but I have to work this out with you in conversation, and that is that I think it's not so much one came first as much as that is a kind of rationale for engaging in, for example, torture or extreme forms of violent coercion went hand in hand and evolved simultaneous with an impulse to take advantage of circumstances. And what I mean by that is sometimes the action is driven by people who honestly are not concerned with these high questions of the morality of X or Y. or the justice of labeling Indians barbaric or not. So, for example, in the case of the so-called Paxton Boys, who were a group of Central Pennsylvania Euro-Americans who massacred Conestoga Indians shortly before the American Revolution. I think that was, I can't get into the minds of those men, but I think their rationale was fairly overt, simple, outright racism against the Conestoga Indians and in a desire to remove them from the colony as retribution for other Indian actions elsewhere. What is important about the response to them is then how people who were not present at the massacre, weren't responsible for the massacre, then made sense of it. So I guess that's part of what I would emphasize here, that there are actions on the ground that may be motivated by all of the crass and or complicated motivations that any human may have. But then when the larger society discusses their actions and comes up with a rationale for it, I think the ways in which that rationale are laid out is a very important part of the story.
So there's almost like concentric circles the need for rationale maybe increases as you get a little further away from the actual action itself, from actually perpetrating the action, because it becomes a reflection on your society at large.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. And it especially becomes important for those people who are in positions of authority or positions of influence who are trying to articulate whatever the mission of this society is, whether it's in the case of someone like Benjamin Franklin, he's trying to elevate. He was a critic, a savage, or I should use that word, a very stern critic of the Paxton Boys, very eloquent. In his case, he's somehow trying to speak to other Americans, by which I mean other colonial Euro-Americans, as well as back to England and to Europe, to reassure people that, yes, we can create a civilization here. We are not going to be savages.
And then as you get into the 1800s, you have, differing contexts for which torture and this type of, physical and mental punishment is justified. In the context of prisons, it's perceived as rehabilitative.
Yes, and I think one of the important points about that notion of somehow physical coercion can be part of rehabilitation is that it sets up a logic which is an incredibly powerful logic which persists in the American imagination to the present day. And that is sometimes we need to physically coerce people to do what's in their best interest, even if that means we have to do things that may appear to some of us as equivalent to torture. And they were perceived to be equivalent to torture in that era, whether it was 24/7 isolation, which they tried at the turn of the 19th century. And they discovered very quickly that it had very severe mental health consequences. But nevertheless, they rationalized that, well, that was what was necessary in order to produce the appropriate introspection on the part of prisoners so that they came to recognize their wrong ways and corrected their behavior. In other instances, there was the idea that, well, nothing will get through the mind of a hardened criminal other than physical violence. And so you have to use violence to compel a prisoner to act the way society wants him to act because he otherwise won't act that way. So in either case, you can come up with a justification for physical coercion. And the interesting issue is that those who advocated direct violence to the body through flogging and through something that was called the water shower, which is sort of like a 19th century version of waterboarding, those folks justified that by saying that only physical pain would compel proper behavior. Others who came up with forms of what we might call mental torture that didn't involve physical pain per se claimed that physical pain was barbaric and that their methods, such as isolation 24/7 from any contact with people, were more humane. So in that case, you can see whichever tactic you chose, you could make the argument it was preferable.
How did that contrast with the perspective of physical and punishment and I guess mental to a certain extent of slaves? I mean, was there even that level of rationale, or was it just simply it's my property, I can do what I want?
Well, yes, you're certainly right about that. First off, that's the idea that slaves are my property was not only was it a legal position, a legal tenet, but it was also a kind of practical, widespread belief that slaves were really beyond the conscience, so to speak, of other humans. We didn't have, that is, we who were not enslaved had no obligation per se to be concerned about the plight of slaves. Now, of course, that idea began to break down in the late 18th century as a result of the American Revolution and other influences, but it was still a very powerful idea and a legal principle through until the time of the Civil War. And so I think one of the really enormous challenges for opponents of slavery, abolitionists, was to somehow convince Americans that, in fact, it was possible to torture a slave. And it seems self-evident, perhaps, to us today that that would be the case. The enslaved were human beings. But if you start from the premise that, in fact, the enslaved are a baser form of humanity, whether you believe that on the basis of racism or you believe that on the basis of some idea that somehow Africans are a more primitive form of human beings, all of the rationales that white Americans came up with, you could then justify the idea that, well, somehow the enslaved don't feel pain the way we do, or the enslaved are so primitive that we have to use these methods, or they are enslaved, so they have no rights that we are obligated to recognize, which is pretty close to what the Supreme Court ruled in the Dred Scott decision in 1858. So for the challenge for especially African-American abolitionists, I think, was to establish at a very fundamental level that they were human beings who suffered pain and had a conscience that could be tormented the same way white Americans suffered pain.
And my sense is that the following the war and the story of Andersonville, because what's interesting about this story to me is it seems that prior to this time, at least in terms of broad-based American psyche, right, that people who are tortured are either not people, as you've talked about with the slaves, or are a special class of people who have, you know, broken the law and are outside of like sort of normal societal bounds or something like this. But in the context of Andersonville, it seems like that desire to, not have to confront what lives within our society is somehow that muscle started to really flex.
Yes, I think you're right. And that, I think one of the extraordinary acts of, I'll call it erasure, of historical erasure or amnesia, is about American Civil War prison camps. And we could argue endlessly, as many people have, those who are interested in this topic, and there haven't been that many actually, we could argue endlessly about whether Confederate prisoner of war camps were worse than Union prisoner of war camps, or whether Union officers or Union administrators wanted to treat Confederate prisoners cruelly or vice versa. We can argue that all we want, but what we lose sight of or have lost the sort of collective memory of is that there was enormous suffering during the American Civil War in prisoner of war camps, and both white Northerners and black Northerners, and I should say white Northerners, black Northerners, and white Southerners believed that there was rampant intentional cruelty in these camps. And if there wasn't, well, there was intentional cruelty on some occasions, but even apologists would acknowledge that there was horrific conditions in these camps. And the curious thing is we don't recognize that this was a moment in time when the, if you will, the kind of veil was pulled back, and white Americans in particular could have seen that we white Americans are capable of doing extraordinarily or allowing extraordinary hardship and cruelty to other whites. And that was a moment in time that Americans could have, in essence, looked at themselves in the mirror. I mean, there were other times when they could have as well. But they could not have escaped that it was white Americans who allowed this to happen or did this to other white Americans.
What's interesting, too, about Andersonville, like on one hand, one would think like, OK, well, the reason why we don't hear stories of how Confederate soldiers were essentially subjected to what amounted tantamount to torture is because the Union Army won and they get to write the history. But Andersonville is the opposite, where Union soldiers were treated to what amounted to torture. And on one hand, I can understand, like, okay, I can see the the President Lincoln or Union Army official saying we're not going to make a big deal of this because we need to heal the country at this point. But it also is remarkable. There is at the very least, even if that's the reason why it's being done, I feel like on some level we're haunted by this notion of turn the page, right? Because literally, you know, 150 years later, that's what President Obama is saying about our torture program in Iraq.
Yes, yes. And the people who are responsible for turning the page are sometimes, exactly as you said, the people you would expect to be responsible. I mean, again, not to mitigate what turning the page meant, but one can understand that after a civil war of the magnitude and of the bloodshed of the American Civil War, and you're trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to stitch this nation together? You have to make some decisions on the fly of what you're going to talk about, what you're going to focus attention on. And one can understand why some people would decide that, well, in the interest of national reconciliation, there's certain things we're just not going to dwell on, like, for example, the treatment of Union prisoners by Confederates. But there are others who participated, and I won't get in the weeds long here, but just to say that, for example, you probably didn't immediately think to yourself that, well, professional historians played a role in this amnesia about prison camps. But they did. In the early 20th century into the mid-20th century, professional historians played a large role in discounting any evidence of the full horror of the prison camps and offering excuses for them. And that was driven by impulses partially internal to the historical profession, but it was also driven by that broader interest of white Northern historians and white Southern historians finding some sort of common ground where they could agree on terms about the Civil War. And in the process, they decided, if you will, much like the national leaders, that, well, let's just not make a big issue out of the Civil War prison camps.
And then we have this phenomena from, and it stretches probably earlier than the Civil War, but I would imagine the intensity of people coming out of that war, it makes it much easier for people in law enforcement to justify torture of prisoners. As you talk about from, I guess, you know, from the late 1800s into the almost up until the World War II, this seems to be fairly rampant amongst police departments. Tell us about that and how it ends, or that era ends.
Yeah, there are many aspects of American history that they sort of develop organically, and after the fact, it's hard to imagine what it was like before them. And one of them is police, of course. The United States had local communities in the United States had very fragmentary, if that would be the proper word, police forces of any kind, really before the 1840s. And then a few American cities started to mimic the British, particularly London, practice of having actually professional police forces. But they're really quite small on the whole and rather ad hoc until after the Civil War. But as you mentioned, I think the influence of the Civil War, the kind of organizing principle of the war and the military experience, meant that police forces after the Civil War became much more professional. They adopted many attributes of the military in terms of ranks of officers, uniforms, codes of conduct, etc. And they also assumed a very particular role, which was they weren't just to maintain order, which is what constables had done in the past, but they were also supposed to gather evidence to help the state prosecute wrongdoers. Which, if you think about it, those we sort of take it for granted that's what police do, but that's not what police have to do. You could have the two different functions separated, as, for example, they do in many other countries of the world, so that police aren't developing evidence so much as they are maintaining the order. There are others who do the evidentiary work. Well, what this gets to is, as you could imagine, if police are simultaneously maintaining order and supposed to also generate evidence, this is an era when in the United States there was virtually no forensic science like we see on CSI, and really until the 1920s and 1930s. So that meant if you were a policeman, how did you find out what happened? Well, you talked to witnesses. If you didn't have witnesses, there was a temptation then to look for the usual suspects and then figure out if there were ways in which you could muscle the information out of them. So by the 1880s, newspapers began reporting very widely about various techniques that police had used. One was sweating, where you put a suspect in a very hot room until he breaks down and will confess. Then there was the so-called third degree, which might involve all manner of physical coercion. And then there were other more elaborate things, which were taking someone and putting them in the presence of the murder victim they allegedly had murdered, make them hold the murder weapon, and various other forms of what we would now call psychological duress. And these, by the 1890s, 1900s, had become so commonplace, they were referred to under that umbrella label of the third degree. And newspapers would publish forthright stories about such and such suspect as being given the third degree. And this was the commonplace practice up until really the 1930s, when, as a result of a series of Supreme Court decisions, the Supreme Court began to limit the ability of police and district attorneys, prosecuting attorneys, to use coerced confessions.
Was that?
So it was a long process.
Was that a development of legal thought, or was there a popular pushback on this?
Oh, there was definitely a popular pushback, and I think the key to the popular pushback, well, there were several things that come together, but I think one of the crucial things was prohibition, because prohibition meant that there was a dramatic expansion in police activity trying to, you know, ferret out whoever was involved in consuming and or trading in illegal alcohol during Prohibition in the 20s. But simultaneously, there was a kind of just pervasiveness of police surveillance. And that meant that a lot of people had contact with the police in the 1920s for doing something that had just a few years before been legal.
Right.
And these were people who previously would not have been subject to police brutality. What I mean by that is white middle-class men and women, all manner of people who had exposure to police methods that they had been unfamiliar with or had assumed, oh, well, those were methods that were used for people who deserved to be treated that way. So during the 1920s, there was a real sense that the police were out of control. And I would add to that, Hollywood contributed in its own way by making all of these movies, the so-called gangster movies of the late 20s, early 30s, which depicted the third degree routinely. So there was some of the mystical quality, the mythic quality of the third degree was punctured, and instead it was seen to be, you know, just plain old brutal force.
Skip over the sort of the extended tradition of police torture, which, you know, up until they found a basically what amounted to a black site in Chicago a couple of years ago, where this practice was obviously still continuing. And, you know, we have stories from New York Abner Louima and, I mean, others.
Yeah.
But I want to just talk about Vietnam to a certain extent, because
sure.
That seems to be, you know, this theme of never really addressing these problems. And folks can apply this dynamic, I think, to a whole host of societal ills, particularly in terms of abuse of power by our institutions. But in many respects, it seems to me that what happened with torture in Iraq, and even what is going on today in Guantanamo on some level, or just institutions where we isolate prisoners today, part of that was our failure to really address it in Vietnam, even though we address so much, it seems to me, about our our involvement in Vietnam.
Well, you know, I guess I would separate out what happened in Vietnam. I would draw a distinction. I think you're right about what happened in Vietnam with regards to the CIA. But the Army, or I'm talking about the Army, meaning the American military forces,
right.
I should say. I think the American military forces did take some very clear lessons from Vietnam. The case in Vietnam was such a quagmire. Oh, it's a trite to almost say that, but it was such a quagmire of different entities, different militaries, if you will, engaged in such a brutal war, so that there were the South Vietnamese military was engaged in torture. There was the American military working with the South Vietnamese army engaged in torture. And then there's the CIA operating its own programs, sometimes with the American military and sometimes on its own, working also with South Vietnamese intelligence forces. So there were a lot of different actors there. But I do think that one of the important things that came out of the Vietnam War was that within the American military, there were some very, very, within the Pentagon, there was the emergence of a robust cadre of human rights, international law, law of war specialists that emerged in became rooted in the Pentagon in the 1970s and 1980s. And I think what is important to remember about them is it's those officers who were trained in human rights and international law and the laws of war who provided some of the most important resistance to the war on terror's excesses in the George Bush administration. If it hadn't been for people for constantly throwing sand in the gears in the Pentagon, I think the war on terror would have been far more, the excesses would have been far more pronounced.
Interesting.
Now, with regards to the CIA, there were, of course, hearings held in 1973 that would extend on into the excesses of the CIA, not just in Vietnam, but elsewhere. And there were efforts to roll back the CIA, of course, and that happened briefly, we'll say in the late 70s and into the 1980s. But under Reagan, the CIA, of course, ramped things back up again and was also working with all sorts of regimes across Latin America and Southeast Asia during the 1980s and into the 1990s. So that I would definitely agree with you. I'm not sure the CIA ever learned the lessons one might have hoped they would have learned after the fiasco in Vietnam.
Well, they certainly didn't, I don't think, had too much of a reason to learn it after Iraq either, right? I mean, we now have a director of the CIA who oversaw the torture of at least, I think documented at least one prisoner. We have... I just saw the other day that the guy Rodriguez, who was responsible for getting rid of the torture tapes, I think that's his name, was they named a school after him or something to that effect. He was just literally in the news the other day. It was in passing, but he was commemorated in some fashion. This seems to me to be sort of. You could have laid out the same theories just by looking on this era, right?
Yep.
Just expand on that for a moment.
Well, yes, I think that was one of the I worked, so to speak, backwards from someone would say I was very presentist about this, but I became interested in this because my very first research as a historian in graduate school was on the phenomenon of lynching of African Americans in the American South. And so I knew there was a tradition of not only extra legal violence, but also of extra legal torture on a massive scale, and one that was tolerated, if not openly saluted, celebrated by many people. So then when I was responding, like many Americans, to the photographs of Abu Ghraib, from learning more and more about the enhanced interrogation program, I was asked myself, well, why is this, how is this rationalized, on what basis could we adopt these programs? And looking, as you said, what I've been struck by is the repetition of a kind of argument that, well, we have to adopt these extreme methods because the threat to our way of life is so extreme. In the case on the war on terror, it's because we have these barbaric Islamic terrorists who do not accept the rules of civilization, the rules of war, and they will use any methods to destroy us. So we have to go, as Dick Cheney put it, to the dark side. That is, in a nutshell, the rationale that has been repeated time and time again for adopting methods that otherwise we allege we would never do. So I think the fundamental point is we always tell ourselves that we only adopt torture in extreme circumstances, whereas other people in the world apparently do torture because it's somehow part of their innate civilization or their innate way of government. So ours is always keeping torture at a distance as something that we don't really do unless we're forced to do it, which is a very convenient way to constantly restore American innocence, to constantly say that our society is somehow purer than others.
I should say that I just the Rodriguez thing is in the new spy museum, I guess, and he is basically put into a two sides of the coin about whether we should be torturing. And yeah, which is but literally given an opportunity to you know, in an interview to say that that torture saved lives.
I suspect, though, does he actually use the word torture, or
of course, it's enhanced interrogation, yeah. And yes.
Of course.
Well, but so let me ask
that's
you this.
The other thing, it's euphemism always. We don't torture, we do enhanced interrogation, whereas those other people, they torture.
Wait, is this uniquely American? I mean,
no.
Okay, so no. I mean, it's not. I mean, where is there an element of this sort of rationale uniquely American, or is it simply this is how people around the world do bad things? They say when we do it, it's slightly different than bad.
Yes, well, I think you're right. There are aspects of this that are definitely uniquely American. What I would say is, part of American exceptionalism is the ways there's a particular stake, I think, for the American way of life in claiming that we are the last best hope, to use Lincoln's phrase, the last best hope for democracy, and that somehow we matter more, not just now because we're the most powerful nation on the planet, but even in the 19th century when we were far from the most powerful nation on the planet, there was the idea that somehow American democracy represents what is most modern, most progressive, most civilized civilization. So it's important for that ideal of American democracy to be innocent and pure and constantly in a state of achieving its perfection. And torture is, unfortunately, for those who would justify it, torture is not, you can't reconcile torture with the idea of a modern, progressive, innocent civilization, democratic civilization. So I think you're absolutely right. That aspect of it is very specific to the United States. But what interests me about, or one thing that interests me about torture and the challenge it poses to democracies is, torture is, of course, antithetical to democracy, because democracy is supposed to rest on the consent of the governed. And it's supposed to rest on the idea that the fair exchange, the full and fair exchange of truth and of knowledge makes possible a public that will consent in the best possible way to achieve the ends that the society is pursuing. So it will pursue the best for the largest number of people. Well, torture doesn't fit into that model. And so I think for any society, so I'll point to Britain. The British are very, very proud of their tradition of rule of law and respect for law, and in many ways it is enviable. But, of course, the British were quite willing to use torture, whether it was in Kenya or Northern Ireland, and have a very difficult history of torture in the 20th century. That doesn't mean the British have ever said to themselves, you know, I mean, some have, but it's not as though the British were any more willing than Americans to somehow come to grips with the fact that they had a society that harbored torturers and that had produce justifications for torture. So I think any democracy is going to be particularly challenged the way, of course, another model of government can either blame it on those who are in power or else justify it as the means, as a form of, as an outgrowth of that form of government.
Okay, so lastly, let me ask you this. I mean, if it's the case that the practice of this sort of the euphemism and the sort of delusion is not uniquely American, but the stakes are, because our story of ourselves is so in contradiction to that notion of torture. What are the implications of A, going from the Bush administration, where Cheney had that 1% doctrine, where it's like, you know, and sort of the popular culture of like, you know, the 24 scenario, you know, the stop a nuclear bomb to, and then in many ways it seems to me making it easier for the guy who becomes the president of the United States to say, we shouldn't be ashamed of torture. We should do it. I mean, other people do it. We should be rough. I mean, literally saying this becoming president. What are the implications of that? I mean, on some level, it makes me feel like, at the very least, the delusion and the aspirations provided some type of check. And without that, things could get a lot uglier.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. We have, prior to the election of President Trump, we have never had a president who openly specifically endorsed torture. I mean, didn't make excuses for it, exactly as you said. So even a president like President Theodore Roosevelt, who, like the Bush administration, came up with all manner of euphemisms and justifications for American violence during the conquest of the Philippines at the turn of the 20th century, he never would use the phrase. He was never going to condone torture, because that was a horrible thing in his mind. So yes, you're right. We have pierced some sort of, we have entered into a new language when a president will openly embrace torture. And I think one of the other point I would make, building on what you said, is that as much as the idea of American purity and innocence can be something that we hide behind, it has always also been a very powerful tool for the opponents of torture. And throughout the history of the United States, and even into the colonial era, there have been fierce, fierce opponents of any rationalization for torture. And they have always used that idea that if we are going to achieve the kind of civilization we aspire to build, if we're going to create the kind of democracy we want, we cannot have torture. And that's a very, very powerful concept, sort of mobilizing the core of the American identity against torture. And I can point out all of the ways in which it has sometimes camouflage torture has been an obstacle to dealing with torture in all of its forms. But on the other hand, it is still one of the best tools any opponent of torture has to use to try to sway public opinion. But in the current environment, I mean, to me, it's less that that we may see torture being used against in the Middle East again. I mean, that may be going on right now. But what concerns me is we have the combination of the rhetoric about using whatever methods we need, and also the demonization of people on our southern border. So I am concerned that we will see more and more accounts of excessive violence and or torture being directed against people along our southern border. And the justification will be that these are people who pose a threat to our nation. They're subhuman, they're gang members, whatever the rationale is, and we will have heard it before.
Fitz Brundage, the book is Civilizing Torture, an American Tradition. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book on our page at majority.fm.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we got to take a quick break here. Head into the fun half. Went a little long there, but fascinating stuff. just a reminder, you can support this show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And by becoming a member of the show, you support the free show, and then we give you extra content every day. We try to, and it's commercial free. So you have all of that as a benefit of being a member. Meanwhile, just a reminder, Calm and Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that's designed with high-density comfort fill to promote a sense of calmness for a restful night's sleep. The Calm and Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. Right now, our listeners can go to calmandcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJOR15 at checkout to receive $15 off the displayed price. Again, that's calmandcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJOR15, because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Michael's not here, but presumably he'll be here tomorrow night for the Michael Brooks show.
Yeah, and I think we might be eating the food bucket tomorrow night.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
He'd better rest up for that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's doing a cleanse right now.
Have you heard of the term mukbang, Sam?
Mukbang?
Yeah, I was just introduced to it. It's apparently a South Korean thing started, but it's just people eating on camera. Oh, yeah. Muk is like food and bang is broadcast, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
So we might mukbang the food.
They've got videos of that at Mission Chinese Food restaurant I just went to the other night.
Oh, yeah. That's a good restaurant.
Super good.
Is that like, what do you call it, that MRS? What is that?
I think it is similar to ASMR.
ASMR.
Yeah. It's weird.
It's weird stuff.
That's the parallel I'm drawing, is they're both weird.
Well, competitive eating is a big thing in Japan.
Well, I've been there. I've done that.
Competitive eating?
I've been in like a
hot dog
eating contest, sure, back in the day. Rum chugging, all of it. I've done all of it, folks. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
I'm so glad you asked. So, if you could not get enough of our 90s episode with Katie Halper last week, we have released a bonus for our patrons where we do even more 90s talk with Katie Halper and we sing a song. So, that's fun. We also recorded an episode over the weekend with the Marxist geographer Sam Stein that I'm very excited to release this week.
On Literary Hangover, we discussed The Song of Hiawatha by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, a very sort of famous poem that has really gone out of date since then. We talk about maybe why that is. We talk about Edgar Allan Poe being really racist about Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And his attempts at writing anti-slavery poetry, which on the other hand, like the abolitionists were like, slave drivers could read this in the morning and still eat their breakfast fine. So he wasn't exactly a radical. So it's kind of interesting. He's an interesting guy and probably forgotten because he wasn't bold enough artistically in terms of his politics. So
there you go.
Got to be bold.
Speaking of bold, I refrained from asking last week, but is it really Hiawatha as opposed to Hiawatha?
That Longfellow himself pronounced it Hiawatha. Yep.
Oh, so now he's, despite all that, now you say he is the arbiter.
Well, the thing is his creation of Hiawatha, Hiawatha the man was an Algonquin, and Longfellow makes him an Ojibwe Indian in the Song of Hiawatha. So it's very ahistorical, but I make that point.
So it could be Hiawatha.
It could be.
Because I grew up saying Hiawatha.
Yeah, I don't want to take that away from you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All right, folks, going to head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. We'll take your calls. Don't forget, join themajorityreport.com.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.